Book for Luggage Stolper presents Leadership in Statecraft, Studies in Power, edited by Kurt Almqvist, Alistair Benn, and Matthias Hesserus, read by me, Helen Lloyd. Epicurus, Lucretius, and the Myth of Mythlessness by David Butterfield. Leadership and statecraft are intimately intertwined. After all, you cannot craft a state without knowing how to lead. And rather more fundamentally, you cannot lead any populace into crafting a state unless there is some sense of common identity or purpose. The germain question for good and sustainable statecraft, therefore, lies farther upstream. What is the process whereby a society comes to feel that it is communally associated and somehow in it together? This is a large and complex question, and certainly not one that can be answered succinctly. Given the scope of this essay, I do not propose to wade out ill-advisedly into anthropological or socio-political waters. Instead, I wish to explore the most primitive and primary catalyst for binding people together and creating the stable environment from which states can emerge. Myths. Just what are myths? To the modern reader, this word seems to be the polar opposite of history proper, historical fiction, not fact. The Greek mythos meant story and was often opposed to logos, rational account. On such a model, myths are mere tales forged by design or happenstance. They are told and retold, either to give people a sense of place in their world or to peddle and propagate some religious or ideological dogma. Nevertheless, it is a mistake to regard such myths, however true or false, as divorced from the daily realities of people's lives, then and now. In actuality, these shared stories frame and tailor the past in a way that can ground and stabilize a community, however large or small. By situating them within the fabric of history, myths provide a sense of tradition and belonging to rally around. Whether they are preserved orally or via literary texts or sacred scripture, they are a tradition that orientates and steers the community. Such is the binding value of myths, that they will be kept alive, refreshed and renewed, as and when the times require. Yet we can only progress so far with generalizations like these. In order to find the specifics that will illuminate these claims, my instinct as a classicist is to delve back into the world of ancient Greece and Rome. Among the colourful and conflicting ideas of that age, I will turn to a particularly radical and controversial philosophy, one which will give us serious pause for thought in our modern era. Myths had multiple modes in antiquity, some more fundamental than others. Among the most important and essential were the fantastic founding myths that ancient cultures told themselves. Athens, for instance, was founded by the goddess Athena when victorious over her sea god brother Poseidon. Thebes was founded by the Phoenician king Cadmus after he slew a dragon and generated warriors by planting the dragon's teeth. Rome was founded by Romulus after his fellow wolf-raised brother disagreed about whose hill should host the new city. And in a yet earlier sense, the Roman race was founded by the exiled prince Aeneas, fleeing Troy after the Greeks had prevailed. Each of these foundational tales placed citizens in a shared narrative of divine favour, connecting them with larger-than-life figures from the past. Such stories were kept vibrant and relevant by their recurrence in literature, art, and religious cults. For ancient Greeks and Romans alike, the lines between myth and history were always blurred. Most people did indeed believe in the heroic cast of ancient literature as historical figures, directing their debates instead to questions about which particular tales were the truest. Even if there was always intellectual scepticism from some quarters, that rarely ranged far outside the ivory towers of academia. Yet these tales, so implicated in each city's identity, were not without political consequences. When Julius Caesar started claiming that he was ultimately descended from Rome's founding father Aeneas, and thus from his mother Venus, he did so by depicting the goddess on his coinage and placing that connection in the literal hands of Romans. Not long after, he broke the age-old taboo and displayed his own face there too. Such assertive acts of myth-making laid the ground for his own godhood. After his dictatorship and assassination in 44 BC, his supporters chose to deify him, an act approved by the appearance of the Julian star, as Halley's Comet did the rounds that July. In turn, this romantic forgery helped inaugurate the Julio-Claudian imperial line from Divus Augustus to the no less divine Nero. The convention, once established, was not abandoned thereafter, and so the Roman Empire advanced to shape most of Europe and the Mediterranean, and a millennium later, much of the wider world. Myths then change societies, for better and worse. But what happens by turn when myths are banished from a society, rejected as not just false but entirely meaningless? What happens when reason declares itself supreme over anything regarded as supernatural or irrational or unexplained? This is not the place to do anything more than cast a wary eye over to the French Revolution and to wonder how much liberté, égalité and fraternité was bestowed on unwitting Parisians by the Enlightenment-inspired culte de la raison. To answer these questions, I turn to a figure who was a counter-cultural radical in ancient Greece. His ancient influence was relatively small in his own day, but would prove to be major some two millennia later. This man was Epicurus, who found his way to Athens from the Greek island of Samos around the year 300 BC, where he established an intellectual community, the Garden. Just like his fellow Samian philosopher Pythagoras, Epicurus's school was open to all comers, being one of the world's first educational institutions that accepted men and women on equal terms. Epicurus's philosophy was formulated in a world replete with rival philosophies after half a millennium of fervid Greek thought. The early philosopher-scientists, such as Thales, Anaximander, Anaxagoras, had sought to understand the world through its material elements. Then Socrates and Plato, driven by logical argument and metaphysical speculation, reached beyond for transcendent truths. Their ethereal ideas were reined in by the unremitting inquiry and experimentation of Aristotle's ever-revolving mind, and in his wake, various rival Hellenistic schools cropped up and chopped up theory to forge the new philosophies of Stoicism, Skepticism, Cynicism, and Epicureanism. To take this account to where it matters, we should summarize the three radical beliefs of Epicurus. The first springs from physics. Everything that exists is either matter, stuff, or nothing, void. And all existing matter is made of indivisible and invisible atoms, something we now take for granted, but which was deemed an absurd theory in the ancient world. Second, we humans, however special we may appear, are accordingly made exclusively of atoms and void. There is no third immaterial part. So, when we die, our atomic bodies and atomic soul, and therefore all that is us, die and disappear too. There is thus no afterlife, only the one life we experience right now. Third, the multiple traditional gods do materially exist, but they do so remotely, having no interest in our world. Since they do not interact with our daily lives, there is no providence, no divine plan, and no goal for the random amalgam of creatures we call the human race. So all religion and superstition are not just a waste of time, but a harmful delusion. These three Epicurean tenets, that nothing is immaterial, that no human lives beyond death, and that there is nothing divine in or about human existence, were incredibly controversial in the Greco-Roman world, in almost all places and periods. Epicureanism was genuinely eccentric. As for the devotees of Epicurus and his worldview, what were they to make of their lives? Simple. They were to devote themselves to pleasure, but not the sensuous pleasures of a dissolute life. Rather, true pleasure was secured by the removal of pains, both physical and psychological. Most importantly, comprehending the rational workings of our universe would dispel the mental miseries of misunderstanding. Epicurus's teachings sought to reveal the rational everywhere and to exclude the irrational. The major cultural obstacle to this mission was myth, especially as preserved in literature. Epicurus did not hesitate to dismiss the Iliad and the Odyssey, those great epic poems of quasi-biblical status, as the mere babblings of Homer. Since these tales told untruths, Epicurus sought to understand how these superstitious tales emerge and have such a hold on society. Epicurus's answer does not survive, but we can reconstruct it by turning to his most famous Roman adherent, the poet Lucretius, who was active in the Republic in the 50s BC. In the hope of captivating and converting his fellow citizens to the counterintuitive philosophy of Epicureanism, Lucretius crafted a remarkably ambitious, almost hubristic work of literature, a six-book, 7,500-verse Latin poem, De Rerum Natura, on the nature of things, that is, on everything. This stubbornly dogmatic and stunningly beautiful poem pursues its graduated curriculum with remorseless logic. It journeys from the microscopic movement of atoms through the workings of our human bodies up to the macroscopic survey of subterranean regions and the heavens above. Despite being a technical poem based on atomic physics, it is replete with Lucretius's personal passion. At repeated points in his poem, Lucretius dismisses popular myths as foolish misunderstandings of the rational truths of an atomically ordered world. In the latter half of Book 5, we encounter his famous account of how and why humans evolved. They were a chance creation, anthropomorphic but animal-like primitive humans who were able to survive in their challenging environment. According to Epicurean theory, it was pure chance that they existed as they did and that they were able to survive for an unknown number of generations. Lucretius is curiously ambivalent about whether human societies are in progress or decline. The ingenuity of humans meant that innovation was inevitable and that new and advantageous technologies would accrue. The arrival of these crafts, metalworking, seafaring, militarization, did more harm than good, encouraging commercial greed, power lust, and widespread slaughter. Lucretius's strong message is that society does not progress hand in hand with the passing of time. Crucially, Lucretius includes among the mixed blessings of human ingenuity the creation of superstitions about our world. He argues that myths about the gods were devised and propagated by early humans because they failed to understand the phenomena of their lives, be they wondrous events in the natural world or the bewildering experiences of the human mind awake and asleep. Having made this fundamental error, they made the much more harmful misstep of assuming that the gods were actively in control of human life, and that they demanded sacrifice and appeasement to avoid wreaking their vengeful wrath. So for Epicureans, humans are utterly devoid of purpose. They are neither created for anything nor going anywhere. Worse than that, the tales they tell about mankind's origin, divine providence and future glories are false and pernicious. Epicurus's solution was to retreat from the misguided world and to spend his life in quiet philosophical contemplation with friends. We may sympathize. The outcome for any society that believes itself to be unrooted from any broader frame of purpose is inevitable. It immerses itself in the vivid present. The current moment, here and now, is paramount in the absence of any shared duty to the past or communal hope for the future. This presentism has a feedback loop. It inevitably distracts people from active participation in broader structures, the nation, the civic community, and even the family, and instead turns the focus reflexively onto the individual. Two outcomes soon follow from such a stance. First, there is a withdrawal from politics. After all, why have a stake in shaping the public sphere when your concerns do not extend beyond yourself? The ancient Greeks in Athens and elsewhere had a name for such apolitical figures, an idiotes, which rather revealingly lies behind our own idiot. To give up on the activity of your polis or city was to behave like a self-absorbed fool. In turn, if citizens chose to withdraw from the public sphere and band together around a new private entity, they would soon retreat into a cult unfettered by wider community restraints, and with no mooring in the grand historical frame, they could find themselves spinning out of control. Second, if all people are reduced by such an outlook to mere individuals, bereft of shared traditions and any civic grouping between single units and all humankind, then everyone is in practice reduced to mere identical units in the body politic as a whole. This creates the void of meaning in which authoritarian figures cannot just emerge but reach for totalitarian solutions. The populace at large is primed to receive a new binding ideology, not one organically formed and shaped over generations from the bottom up, but one imposed anew from the top, and perhaps based on nothing real at all. Both of these outcomes, foregoing any stake in the political sphere to retreat into an orthodox cult or opening the door and ushering in a dictatorial ideologue, are manifestly societal failures. To take the position that societies are harmed by their socially constructed myths is not just unhelpful, but empirically unsound. What is more, it is untrue. But told to give certain ideological groups their legitimacy, in other words, it is a myth. The fact is that cross-culturally, throughout the human world, myths are ubiquitous, both in the present and in the past. In almost all societies, they help embed a sense of meaning and belonging. And for that purpose, the truth or falsehood is largely irrelevant so long as it serves to ground and bind a community. While many of these mythic traditions may, if misapplied or distorted, emerge to be harmful or deleterious, in all cases they do forge a body politic that leads to a coherently crafted state. To close, we may return to Lucretius as a sobering case study of my argument. For his rational philosophy adopted the very irrationality it feared. Epicurus had argued that living a life free from pain could give you a life worthy of the gods. Remarkably, Lucretius not only accepted this, but came to regard his master as godlike. In fact, in one famous line he declares, Deus ille fruit Deus, that man was a god, a god. Withdrawn from the socio-political fray of life in late Republican Rome, Lucretius relapsed into a fundamental devotion to Epicurus as the sole gospel, ignoring the many philosophical and scientific developments in the quarter millennium between his master and himself. Lucretius sought out the words of Epicurus alone, and with the zeal of a fundamentalist. Despite the rational truths that had been revealed in the world outside, the intellectual shutters of Lucretius's mind remained closed. We know nothing of the man's own life, Perhaps he lived the life of a rebel, perhaps that of a recluse. At any rate, this astoundingly beautiful poem, one of the most arresting artistic achievements in world literature, failed to change the world as he hoped. Its chief influence, evidenced most notably in the Augustan poets Virgil, Horace, and Ovid, was literary. No surviving author from the first 100 years after Lucretius's death cited the work directly, and no Roman testimony survives praising the poem's intellectual achievement. On the contrary, the Christian Church Fathers, most prominently Lactantius, mocked and vilified it as the dangerously misconceived undertaking of a delirious author. In a similarly malicious spirit, tales circulated in later chroniclers, such as St. Jerome, about Lucretius committing suicide by drinking a love potion. Lucretian ratio, or reason, was defeated by human reality. Perhaps this is the idea with which to close. Societies without myths, without those tales we each tell ourselves for all manner of reasons, are without meaning, and such societies can and will be misled, steered towards certain disaster and destruction. The only uncertainty for these deracinated communities is when, not if, that sad fate comes.